This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents This Is Me, Loving the Person You Are Today by Chrissy Metz with Kevin Carr O'Leary. This is Chrissy Metz. To my mom, my grams, Nama, and my sisters, Monica, Morgana, and Abigail. Some days she has no idea how she'll do it, but every single day it still gets done. To the moon and back, Chrissy, XL. Introduction. Hey, you. Yes, you. Looking all cute and stuff. Y'all don't even know how excited I am to finally talk with you. I have to tell you, the weirdest thing. As I've been putting together this book for you, I've been seeing a lot of bees. Honeybees are meaningful to me because technically they're not supposed to be able to fly. Well, we know they do. But in the 1930s, French scientists proved they couldn't. Their reasoning was that it was aerodynamically impossible because honeybees' wings are too small to support the weight of their bodies. And yet, through some miracle, there they go, zipping through the air and soaring their little honeybee hearts out. I get that. I'm not supposed to be able to fly either. And as a kid, I was always too much. Or not enough. I heard it time and again. Whether it came from my stepfather who tormented me, or the first boy I loved who would kiss me but never claim me. In Hollywood, I spent 10 years hearing some form of, yeah, not you, as I continued to look outward for validation and confidence. Meanwhile, I married and divorced a wonderful man because I didn't know how to love myself. It was only once I stopped looking for outside validation and looked inward instead that I realized I have all I need to fly. Our true happiness is inside of us. Like me, everything you need to fly, to soar, has been inside you all along. Just as you are enough. I know we're going to talk about important things in this book, but I don't want it to be homework. I would rather we be somewhere chatting than taking a quiz. Still, much as in This Is Us, there might be a good cry involved every now and again. What I've learned from the show is that there are so many ways we can connect if we're willing to be vulnerable. Sharing the things that we're afraid will make us appear less in others' eyes makes us stronger. Because confidence really is trust in yourself, right? It has nothing to do with what someone else thinks of you. It's what you think of you. And as we collectively share our truths, I believe we're placing deposits into our own confidence bank. Not only does sharing your truth help other people, but then you feel good and you come to realize your value. When you then build on that value and continue to be a positive person, you can be a light for others in getting out of their own way. Lately, I've been getting this question a lot in interviews. If you could go back in time and tell yourself anything, what would it be? Just try, is what I always say. For me, it was, I'm not going to try to lose weight because if I can't lose 100 pounds overnight, I ain't doing it. And maybe for you, it's, I could never be a lawyer because I could never make it through law school. Or maybe you don't even want to think about what your dream would be because nothing has worked out for you before. I consider myself a work in progress, and this book is full of things I learned from teachers, guides, and mentors I have encountered on my journey. It's my way of paying it forward from my perspective. This book isn't about getting taller, skinnier, richer, or more successful. It's about loving yourself and realizing the singular gifts we all have to offer each other. For me, I always had a love of storytelling. I wanted people to relate to me, so I started asking, how do I relate to them? Acting just happened to be the way I could connect to people. It took way more than a minute for me to achieve my dream, but I'm glad I stayed around. Because there was some time when I didn't want to. I couldn't even get an audition most of the time. I got discouraged, but something told me to keep going. I showed up for myself, and it turned out to be acting. I should tell you that a few years back, an American study revealed that those French scientists missed something special about the honeybee. They had assumed that bees flew like other insects. Psh, they got their own way. Bees beat their wings in a shorter arc than the conventional fly, but they do it faster. And when they need to lift a heavy load, in their case nectar, just as in our case a dream, they can beat their wings in a longer arc to get there. And so, throughout this book, I've added Be Mindful lessons from my life that I hope will help you as you carry your load. Let's get there together. Love, Chrissy. 1. Use the pretty napkin. My cell rang just as I was leaving LAX and pulling onto the 405. Am I a Hollywood cliche or what? A pleasant voice filled the car, saying a name I couldn't quite make out, followed by, "I'm Oprah Winfrey's chief of staff." Now, I have a lot of funny friends, but Oprah? She's off limits. She's not joke material, okay? But I played the caller's game because the number one rule of improv, never deny. "Well, hi, Oprah's chief of staff," I said, sweetly and efficiently. "How are you?" She repeated her name without missing a beat, probably used to people not believing her. "Miss Winfrey asked me to reach out to check your availability for lunch at her home." "Oh, okay, that's great," I said, playing along. This could be good. I keep a calendar these days, which is so dang helpful, but almost too grown up for my liking. Point being, even if you figure it might be a joke, triple check you don't double book yourself for the first time Oprah invites you to her house. "Great," she said, "we'll be in touch." Now, I'm sure a call from Oprah's camp should always be kept private, but there was one person I just had to tell. I mean, come on. "Hey, Mom," I said. "Guess who wants to maybe have lunch with me?" The next call came while I was actually on the phone with my mom, and again, I was coming home from the airport. "Hold on, Mom," I said, switching lines. "Hi, Chrissy, it's Oprah." "Lord have mercy. Here's the thing, y'all. You think you'd be able to handle an out-of-the-blue call from Oprah, but I'm here to tell you, you're not. You start thinking about everything you've learned from her. All of her performances, her generosity, her wisdom, her Oprah-isms. She's been one of your mentors your whole life. And now, she's on the phone. With me. Me. Just chatting with Opes, like, you know, we've been friends forever. I'm sure this is how everyone who speaks to Oprah feels. Of course, she immediately puts you at ease, even as you're trying to maintain your composure. The conversation happened so quickly, but here's what I distinctly remember. She loves This Is Us, and she knows I exist. Oh, and she wanted me to come to her house for lunch. What would you wear to see Oprah? See? It's tough, right? Not too dressy, but something that says you've given your outfit thought. I went with an aubergine cotton dress from Torrid, paired with a gray knit sweater and navy blue tie-up flats from Saks. It's about an hour's drive from my apartment in L.A. to her estate in Montecito, a beautiful area right on the south coast of Santa Barbara. My friends all thought I was crazy to drive myself. I value alone time and I appreciate independence, okay? As I got closer to Montecito, I started second-guessing myself. I hadn't even gotten my car washed. Trying to catch me riding dirty to Oprah's. And she did. I pulled up to a very unassuming gate, and just as I thought I must have the wrong place, a young guy walked up. He was about 21 with ginger hair, wearing a crisp polo. "Can I help you?" he asked. "Hi, yeah, I'm Chrissy Metz," I said. "I'm here to see Oprah. Oprah Winfrey, Miss Winfrey." "Oh, yeah, of course," he said, starting to walk up the driveway. "I'll lead you there." "Well, do you want a ride?" I asked. "I can take you because I have a car." He paused, very calm, but trying not to laugh. No, thank you. I have the golf cart. You can follow me." Oh, God, I thought to myself, I have a car? I was just trying to be helpful. You can't see the estate from the gate, and I didn't want the youngin' walking a 5K while I followed him. We rounded the corner to this beautiful cobblestone driveway that went on forever. "Where are you taking me, Ginger Man?" I said out loud, because it took about another half mile before I even saw anything that looked like a house. Finally, we rolled up to this huge fountain in the middle of a lake and this gorgeous estate perfectly placed behind it. I literally stopped my car when I saw the house. Oh my God. I was just about to grab my phone to take a picture when I checked myself. "Chrissy, are you trying to get kicked out before you're even in?" I asked myself in my full Gainesville voice. "No, ma'am. No, ma'am. You just put your little phone down right now." Instead, I pulled into a small parking area. I got out. I took in the scene. I was admiring the rolling hills when I turned to see a sweet-faced gentleman. "Good afternoon, Miss Metz," he said, leading me to the main house. "Hi, I'm here to see Oprah." Like, who else would I be there to see? "Yes, Miss Winfrey's expecting you." Then he handed me a beautiful crystal glass enveloped in a hand-woven silk napkin. It was a ginger and mint iced tea, the most delicious tea this Southern girl ever did taste. I was nervous or parched or both, so I, of course, started gulping it. And to be fair, I'm this way with all cold beverages. He left and I was alone in this enormous foyer. I try to play it cool and just take in everything around me. The beautiful grand piano, French doors that allow you to see out to the ocean. And then I heard it. The voice. Carissy! She said my name just like you want her to. Like she's introducing you to the world and your new life as someone she likes. She's wearing this cute navy blue dress with a cute ponytail, cute glasses, and cute sandals. Did I mention she's cute? Oprah is cute. Oh my gosh, thank you for having me, I said in one spill of words, overwhelmed by excitement and intense Oprah adoration. Your house is so beautiful. She took the smallest beat and proceeded to give me one of the biggest lessons of my life. It is, isn't it? She said it calmly and without apology. She worked her butt off to live in a home she loves. She earned it and she deserves it. And she would do a disservice to herself and the beauty she surrounds herself with if she shrugged it off and deflected the compliment. I'd been in Oprah's presence, what, 2 seconds? And already I had a life lesson? That it's okay for you to say, I worked hard for what I have. I earned it and I'm going to enjoy it proudly. It only affirmed what I was learning. There is something that happens when you are grateful. You continue to receive blessings. Let's go to the garden room, she said. Oprah led me into a room full of topiaries and even more French doors, where there was a round table set for lunch for two. Prior to my arrival, I had been thoughtfully asked about food allergies and preferences. Thank you, Lord, 'cause I don't do the seafood, y'all. We sat down close to each other and started with a spring mix salad with apple, goat cheese, pecans, and a nice light dressing. These greens were just harvested today, she said. Oh, wow, I said, thinking. This is Oprah's garden salad. And as we spoke, I did everything I could to keep eye contact without seeming like a crazy person. I mean, Oprah looked great. She was just back from New Zealand where she was shooting A Wrinkle in Time. She told me about the Blue Lake of Hawea, and her enthusiasm and her love for the island affirmed my desire to visit the country one day. She asked me questions about This Is Us and about my life, and she wanted to know how I got to where I was. As I opened up about my journey, she shared stories about her own trials in dealing with success, the early days when she started to really earn money, and people came out of the woodwork with hands out. A stranger comes up and says, I changed your diaper when you was 5 years old, she said with the Oprah folksy flourish. And you're supposed to pay for their car or their big dream. The next dish was placed on the table, this one a pesto pasta with truffle flakes. I told her how I had 81 cents on my bank account when I started This Is Us, and that now I could visit my family in Florida whenever I wanted. The issue is that when you're not used to having money, your normal is scarcity. You start looking for ways to share your good fortune because you feel so guilty. Oprah did that purse-lip thing she does when she conveys that she heard you but doesn't necessarily agree with what you said. I told her that I had a really hard time trying to decide what I was going to buy everybody for Christmas, for instance. I kept wondering, do I get something everybody can share? I said, or do I cap it off at a certain amount? Maybe get everyone something that they love, no matter what the price is. And not that I'm at that place financially yet. Chrissy, she said, stopping me from sputtering, years ago, I spoke to my attorney because I was having such a hard time. I sat everyone down and I said, this is what you get. This is what you get. So people stop messing with you? No, my family still asks me for money, she said. But you have to decide what is right for you. What do you want to give? What do you want to buy them? It's not about how much it is, because if you bought them a car, what are you going to buy them next year? Okay, there was Oprah life lesson number two, and I was only a few bites into my pasta. You have to be the one to decide what it is that you want to give. It isn't always about money. It's your energy, it's your time, and it's your love. Those of us who are fortunate have to set boundaries because others will imagine what you can give them and hold you accountable for that until their imagined need becomes a debt you owe them. She then asked, as only Oprah can, about my relationship with my body. There had once been an ad for the Oprah show that went, Emotional Eaters, I'm talking to you! I remember how quickly and deeply that resonated with me. She talked to me then in my childhood home, and here I was talking to her in her home. I'm working through a lot, I said. There's so much of my life that I just blocked out because it was too painful or too confusing. I realize now that it is all still there, still so close to the surface. I stuffed my feelings for so long They have to come up and come out for there to be a real healing. She nodded, and this time I knew she understood. Mentally and emotionally, I'm further on the journey, I said, but I feel like my body doesn't reflect that yet. But it's coming, I know that. I started to get a little teary-eyed, and you should know this, I am a crier. I wasn't as a kid, but I am making up for it now. A raspberry and rosewater sorbet was served, and I hoped it would serve as a distraction while I pulled myself together, but there was Oprah watching as I raised my eyes to the ceiling and waved at my face to stop mascara falls. Girl, Oprah said, use your napkin. I looked down at this fine silk white napkin with delicate hand-woven edges. It's too nice, I said. Use a napkin. I did, as I was told. She smiled and I grimaced at the smudges of black. Good, she said. I finally laughed and her smile got bigger. You know, she said, you're one of our lifetime's heroes. I'm not ashamed to say that I looked behind me to see who she was talking about. What? I mean, was I living in an alternate universe? What the heck was in that ginger tea? She leaned in, so I did too. We all have a purpose, she said. Some people are tall oak trees and some people are the beautiful bushes, but everyone has a purpose. There's nobody here on Earth who doesn't have a path or a purpose. An innate destiny. Every human being who comes, comes called. Yes, Oprah really talks like this. Those words went right to my soul. Before I knew it, the dishes were cleared and Oprah rose from her seat. Well, I'll walk you out, she said. And just as we were about to reach the front door, I looked around. Oprah, what's your favorite room in your house? She said, thinking for a minute. Probably my office or my bedroom. Come here, I'll show you. What? We walked up the stairs and she showed me her beautiful office. She told me she chose the color scheme based on the leaves of an olive tree, from the vibrant green of the top of the leaf to the bottom's pale white. Even the books in her library were covered to match. So beautiful. This is the Oprah Oval office, I said. Next, she led me to her bedroom, which was a nice big size, but not crazy enormous. We stopped for a moment and looked out to see the rolling hills meet the road and eventually the shore. This really was the promised land. Around the corner was the closet. I had always dreamed of having a closet with an island in the middle or having clothes to flip a closet like that. Where are your shoes? I pictured this wing of heels and flats, but she just pointed to a nice array of beautiful footwear neatly placed on shelves. There are some friends of mine who have a million pairs of shoes, but I don't, she said. I wear every single one of these. Come on, practicality. We went back downstairs, and right before she walked me to the car, she said, I want to show you my favorite spot. Y'all, Oprah's favorite spot? She brought me to a little clearing by some trees where she meditates. Next time, she said, walking me arm in arm, bring a guest and your walking shoes. We'll walk around the grounds. Next time? She walked me all the way to my car and made no secret of giving it a bit of the side eye. It's dirty, I said. I'm sorry. This is embarrassing. I wouldn't presume you'd walk me to my car. I just wanted to see what you were working with, she said with a laugh. What did it all mean? As we hugged goodbye, I thanked her for inviting me into her home, and she said I was exactly what she thought I'd be. I hopped in my car to head back to the valley, and three thoughts came to my mind. One, how could all this have felt so normal? Two, I really need to wash my car. Three, I had dreamed that lunch into reality. That last one is important. About 10 years before, I took a day trip to Santa Barbara with my boyfriend, who later became my husband, who even later became my ex-husband. We'll get to Marty later. Spoiler alert, he's a great guy and we're still friends. No, seriously. Marty and I had lunch at Giovanni's, a little pizzeria on Coast Village Road. I knew Oprah's famous Montecito estate was very close, and as I sat at the table, I thought, I'm going to meet Oprah one day and live next door to her. So I said just that out loud in a joking way. I want to be in Montecito someday hanging out with Oprah. My wish came true because I put it out there. I truly believe that the things you want can happen, but it starts with asking. Because honestly, I'm someone who is still incredibly flattered that anyone knows my name, let alone Oprah. People ask me what the most surprising thing is about my life recently, and of course that lunch flashes in front of me, but it's all of it. As a teenager, I was the girl sitting on the couch in Gainesville watching Oprah because I didn't have a real mentor. In Los Angeles, I would watch the Hollywood Reporter actress roundtables with my friends because we couldn't afford acting lessons. I know firsthand that it's never too late for you, and it doesn't matter what you look like. The universe responds when you really pursue your heart's desires. Think about what you want. I'll wait. No, seriously. I'm not leaving you alone on this page without you taking a moment to put a request out there. It can be hard to say what we really want. A lot of us, myself included, did not grow up with positive reinforcement. We were not told we could be or do anything we wanted, even if our wish was just to be happy. Whatever you've brought with you to this book, you can't allow those experiences, even traumas, to define you or limit you. And maybe you're afraid that if you say what you want, someone will hear you. You fear the judgment of a loved one or worry that your growth might be a threat to that person. My advice is to give people the opportunity to surprise you and to grow with you as you become the person you want to be. But right now, let's just talk amongst ourselves, you and me. I'll go first. Okay. Yesterday, I was doing an interview with a gentleman from a magazine. It was a casual thing, and my hairdresser was hanging out with us in the room for touch-ups. The interviewer suggested that since I sing on the show, maybe I should think about doing an album. My heart wants that, but I instinctively deflected. Oh, I don't know. I said, you might be the only one who would buy it. The words just hung there. He looked awkward, and I remembered that it doesn't make people feel good when you don't acknowledge the blessings you've been given. We are so afraid of believing that we deserve great things, especially if we do the hard work. You know what? Wait, I said. Yes, I will. I will record an album. I really, really want to. And thank you for thinking that I can do that. My hairdresser took me aside afterward. Chrissy, it was so great that you corrected yourself in that moment. When you're confident in your abilities, it lets other people feel confident in theirs too. And sometimes we have to teach each other. I know that I'm still unlearning everything that I was taught as a kid. And when I was down, people told me that that is where I would stay. But when you are so far down, the only way to go is up. So, think about what you really want your life to be. Picture yourself sitting proud and powerful, and imagine what a day in your life would look like. You might have to start with the protection of stating this as a joke, just as I had done in that pizzeria fantasizing about meeting Oprah. And as you grow, I promise you that your joke will begin to look like a possibility. Once it's a possibility, you can and will make it a reality. Say it out loud and ask for it. And when we meet, I want to hear all about it. 2. Bottle rocket in a beer bottle. Early last summer, I visited my mom in Gainesville, Florida, where I'm from, and we were sitting on the couch going through a box of family pictures together. I found an old one of my father and me, and we're on a swing set, and I'm sitting on Mark's lap. That's what I call him. Not Dad, Mark. In this picture, I look about 3 years old, and we're both smiling. It's the weirdest thing because he looks happy to be with me. Proud, even. I stared at the photo for a second, trying to jog an actual memory of Mark being caring toward me. I don't remember having any kind of bonding experience with Mark, I told my mom. She paused. That's because you didn't. Oh, dang, Mom, I said, laughing. She has absolutely no filter. My mother divorced my father when I was 8, but she didn't say this to be malicious. She was just stating facts. It was a running joke that Mark only wanted boys for a baseball team. Instead, his first child was my big sister, Monica. 2 years later, things were looking up when Philip arrived. And then 5 years later, here comes another girl, me. It was well known that he was disappointed in the lineup. Mark was in the Navy, and our family moved to Yokosuka Naval Base in Japan 6 months after I was born. We would have gone sooner, but they had to wait for me to be old enough for vaccines. My earliest memories of my parents are of the cocktail parties they hosted for my father's Navy buddies. I would try to stay up late with Monica and Philip to not miss out on the fun of sing-alongs to the Doobie Brothers in Motown. My father was charming and a great storyteller, and he seemed so happy. My parents always had a lot of friends. My dad worked at a bar off base, and anyone who met my mom loved that she was a straight shooter. She was always looking for ways to make extra money, even becoming a taxi driver. I asked her later how she learned Japanese well enough to drive people around. I just did, she said. And that's my mom for you. She does what she has to do. She's an incredible baker, and in Japan, she developed a client base of service members who wanted a taste of home and locals who loved an exotic American chocolate cake. She was always working or baking, not to mention raising three kids with a guy who had no interest in diapers or housework. She could sew anything, and in Japan, it was hard for her to find cute clothes that would fit me. I was a chubby little girl. Here's a photo of me in this one dress she sewed with a giant elastic band that she made to look like a belt. I look at it now and I'm like, girl, that is not a belt. That is a fancy rubber band with a buckle. My mom put me in a ballet class and all I could think about was what was for snack. Yeah, plie, give me some pudding. When is snack? I was most excited when it was cheese and crackers, two of my favorite things. I love the outfit, but I really didn't want to do the whole ballet part. So my mom decided, okay, judo. Sigh. I was a strong little cookie, so I think I injured two kids. My mom said sayonara to the judo. I knew I was bigger than my peers, but I didn't give it much thought. I was in a safe bubble of my family, the baby girl who had the coolest toys. Afternoons, we would visit Mark at the bar when all the lights were up. I remember its distinct smell, a blend of cigarettes, alcohol, and old leather. The scent of grown folks' cologne and perfume. We had lunch and Philip would pester Monica until she hit him, and then she'd be in trouble. My sister was always blamed for Philip's mischief or messes he made. We all joke about it now, but Monica was the whipping boy for the actual boy in the family. In his father's eyes, Philip did no wrong. We sometimes went camping on weekends with Mark and his friends in the Navy. The image that many people have of Japan is the skyscrapers and the bright lights of Tokyo. But on those weekends, we would drive to a beautiful, lush campsite near where a river ran wide into a valley. To get there, you had to drive up the mountain and then down the other side. It was steep, and the roads were narrow, like the dive drop of a twisting roller coaster. But that never bothered Mark. What bothered him was my mom's reaction to his driving so close to the edge every time. "Mark," my mom would hiss, and he would ignore her and go even faster to prove a point or just get the ride over with sooner. Inevitably, after he lurched too close to the cliff's edge or had one too many swerves to avoid crashing into an oncoming car, my mom would reach her breaking point. "Mark, stop the car." He would continue to ignore her. "Mark, hello," she said, looking straight at him. "You are not driving my children on this road." It was always the same routine. He'd stop short, so we lunged forward, my mother sputtering words as she got out of the car, ripping open the backseat door to shepherd us out. Philip wanted to stay with Mark, and he would even try to get to the front passenger seat. Mark peeled off as soon as we were out. If Mark's driving was dangerous, it was just as scary to walk along the road down the mountain. But this mountain forest seemed like a fairyland with giant cedar trees blocking out the sky. In the spring, cherry trees exploded in color, leaving blankets of pink and white on the ground. Mark would wait for us, parked where the road leveled off, and then he would begrudgingly take us the rest of the way. Once you were in the valley, the river created a clearing, and the sun shone down on us as we began setting up the tents. Immediately, Philip and Mark would go off fishing for rainbow trout. That was their thing. The campsite had a fish cleaning station, and they would make a big show of gutting and cleaning their catch. Monica and I would go off where the river bottomed out in the clearing and jump off rocks into the water. We'd swim with our sneakers on because the rocks were so jagged. The water was very cold, but you got used to it. I'd float on my back looking up at the woods around us for as long as I could. Afterward, we'd hang up our suits and change into warm clothes to sit by the fire, as my mom made campfire goulash in the biggest pot you've ever seen. Just as it started getting dark, we were given bottle rockets to shoot from empty beer bottles. It was thrilling to me at 5 and 6 years old, that unmistakable zip sound as the rocket sparkled up in the star-filled sky over the river. By the time I was 7, I was jealous of how much attention Mark paid to Philip. On one of the camping trips, I decided I was going to go fishing with them. I'd watched them so many times, I knew what to do, so I sat by the river's edge with Philip's cane pole. I knew you had to keep the hook just on or over the water so it looked to the fish like a fly skimming the surface. The trout jumps for it and gets caught. I caught one after just a minute or so, and it was such a surprise I almost let go of the pole. I handed the fish to my brother, afraid of the hook and afraid of hurting the fish. "Throw it back," I said. "No way," said Philip. I remember turning back and seeing something that looked like pride in my dad's eyes. I was just as hooked as that fish. I caught 7 rainbow trout that day, handing each to Philip or my father who joined in. It was such a special moment because Mark was actually talking to me and even seemed impressed. I didn't see my own accomplishment. I saw my father's reaction to my accomplishment. "Good job, Chrissy," he said. I remember that day so clearly because that was the only time he gave me a compliment. I know that our perception becomes our reality, but I've given this a lot of thought. I am sitting here trying so hard to find one single moment like this, and I come up empty. Thankfully, my grandma came to live in our house in Japan. My mom's mom, Mary Lou, who I called Grams, was always made up, and she left a light cloud of Elizabeth Taylor's gardenia perfume on me with every hug. She wore huge sunglasses with her hair kept short and tinted a slightly redder shade than her natural color. Almost as soon as she arrived, she got a job at the Estee Lauder counter at the base commissary, doling out beauty advice. She looked like she knew what she was talking about, and she backed up her wisdom with kindness. Her repeat customers called her Obasan, which is a Japanese term of endearment for an older woman. Graham's go-to was coral lipstick and a gray eyeliner, which is now my go-to. I would watch her getting ready for work, running her skinny brush through her hair, the hard bristles pulling her look to perfection. I was already perfect to her, as I was, so she never once gave me advice on how I should look. I felt so safe and secure with Grams that I would often spend the night in her room just to feel more of her love. I went to a kid's school on the base, and every single day she would come pick me up to make me lunch at home. All through kindergarten, lunch was always grilled cheese and the best you've ever had in your life. She cut it into 2 triangles, and she would put them corner to corner on the plate. My brother and sister liked it cut into 4 triangles, but 2 pieces looked bigger to me. Even then, I was beginning to associate fullness with safety and contentment. Our relationship wasn't one of those where she spoiled me with gifts or material things. She was just someone who was happy to see me when I woke up in the morning. I didn't worry that my affection or smile wouldn't be returned because someone was in a bad mood or, as I always thought, I had done something wrong. People in my family would sigh and say, "Well, you're a favorite." If I was, it might have been because she saw how much I needed her. I was lonely with my brother and sister being so much older than me. I had only one real friend, a girl who lived next door who we all called Pumpkin. Grams and I might have had more in common than anyone knew, since she was probably lonely too. She left my grandfather, though she was too devout a Catholic to ever divorce him. He moved on with another woman, but for 20 years, she was on her own. She understood men and could give her son-in-law a look that said she knew exactly who he was. In turn, Mark was always a little intimidated by her. One time my parents were arguing, having a huge blowout in the living room. Grams came out of nowhere and stood between them. "You're not going to treat my daughter in that way," she said, stopping time. It was one of those Wonder Woman moments where I realized I was a part of a line of strong women. Grams, my mother, and my sister Monica are the strongest women I've known in life. I think even the strongest women forget how tough they really are sometimes. As I understand it, my father was not faithful to my mother throughout their marriage. It was sometimes hard to deny, like when Grams was at her Estee Lauder counter one day when a reliable customer came up. "Obasan, I saw Mark buying that beautiful necklace for your daughter," she said. "Does she love it?" "Oh," Graham said, playing it off. "I will have to ask." The necklace never materialized, and I hope the woman that he gave it to was thrilled. "We're moving back to Florida," my mom simply announced one day, and it was the first time "we" meant just my mom and us kids. Mark wasn't coming. He got an assignment in Diego Garcia. Yeah, I never heard of it either. It's a tiny island, a ring-shaped coral reef in the middle of the Indian Ocean. My parents were about as far from each other as they could get. The family lore goes that on that very same day the divorce was finalized, Mark married a woman named Judy. When he was back in America and living in Miami, he invited Monica, Philip, and me to camp out with his brother Tom and my cousin Tom, Big Tom, Little Tom. It was the summer before I turned 9. Judy was there, but nobody introduced us. "I got this for you," she said, handing me an art kit of primary colored paints in a plastic container. Oh, I love art, I said, trying to be nice. She went back over to Mark and smiled at him as he put his hand on her lower back. Who is this bitch? I thought. Not my mom, I answered myself. I wouldn't see my father again until I was 21, at a shower for Philip's baby boy. It was at Philip's house, and Mark walked right by me in the family room. Even my high school graduation announcement came back, return to sender. Whenever I go back to Gainesville, I stop to look at the house my mom first found for the four of us. We lived there when my parents were just getting divorced, and when Mark was giving my mom money. It was a proper house, with three bedrooms, two bathrooms, a living room to play in, and a kitchen that seemed huge to me at the time. My mom could bake, and I could help without being told I was in the way. I missed Grams, who moved into a retirement home in West Palm Beach when we got back to Florida. She was a four-hour drive away, but she sent me cards, and I wrote letters. We would each sign them XOXO. I missed seeing her every day, but she did her best to stay close. When school started, the principal said I had to repeat kindergarten to make sure I had mastered the curriculum since I had gone to school in Japan. I took that to mean I wasn't smart enough to be a first grader. But in a way, it was a fresh start. Even though my parents were divorced, I distinctly remember thinking, this is like normal. We had a house, and we even had pets. My brother had a ferret, which escaped, and we had a pet tarantula named Charlotte. Normal people had pets, I told myself. Then normal just dissolved. My mom couldn't afford the house, and we moved into an apartment in what others told you, if you gave them your address, was the ghetto. Our home was now a cramped two-bedroom and a single-level box of tan bricks. I recently asked her how much child support she got from my dad. It was $100 a month, she said, and it wasn't always consistent. She worked as a checkout girl at the Food for Less supermarket, and Monica and Philip got home later from school than me. So I was a latchkey kid in the second grade. The first time I saw the red tag left on the door, I didn't know what it meant. The apartment was old and always seemed dark anyway, and now the lights wouldn't turn on. I went to turn on the TV. Nothing. Our electricity was shut off a lot. In Gainesville, there's a thunderstorm practically every day. I was alone in the dark during a strong one, and after that, I just didn't want to be alone, period. Every day I would go to the grocery store and just walk around. This one was a bit fancier than the Food for Less, and I would pretend I was shopping, playing the part of a discerning customer. I loved the brightness of the place and the feeling of being safe. I spent so much time there every day that I knew the order of the Muzak playlist by heart. It was one long string of 80s power ballads. Wham's Careless Whisper would lead to Laura Branigan asking, "How am I supposed to live without you?" I looked at all the food my family could never afford. I visited Capri Suns, which all my classmates had. I brought the cheaper juice drink and the plastic grenade-shaped jugs in my lunch bag. Oh, and the chip aisle. Stuffed with bags of air and goodness. Real Doritos, not the fake taco chips that we ate. But mostly I just wanted to be around people. The supermarket staff ignored me, probably because I looked away each time they turned to me. I was so afraid of getting kicked out. I respected that they were putting up with me. What is wrong with this girl? I imagined them saying to each other. Is she stealing? Never. First of all, if my mom found out, she would kill me. It would be an insult to her pride. And second, it just never really occurred to me to shoplift. I befriended older kids in the neighborhood who even then I knew were a bad influence. They cursed and they had their own bikes, casually doing loop-de-loops around me as I walked. They would steal from Little Champ, the tiny convenience store near our house. I was a kid who would find a dime or nickel and save up to buy lemon heads. They were the cheapest candy, so I grew to like them. And let's be real here, I really liked chocolate, but lemon heads were better than now and laters. They weren't enough now for me. My mom soon met a guy at work, Evan. He was quite a bit younger, but he was so kind. He came over one time and made us dinner. It was his casserole of cream of mushroom soup and rice with bacon-wrapped chicken. That exact recipe has stuck with me. We all sat at the table and he served us, and he even asked me what I thought of the meal. I was 8 that summer, and like all summers in Gainesville, where it's never below 90 degrees, we spent as much time as possible at the springs. Back then, you could pack up a whole car and pay $10 to get into Blue Springs. Now it's $10 a person. Blue Springs shoots off of the Suwannee River, It's a shimmering, crystal blue work of nature, with a dock right over the deep Springhead Hole, where the water is extra blue. When you go, and you should, everybody's in their bathing suits and having their picnics. People put their watermelons in the water when they arrive, so it'll be nice and cold when they're ready to slice it. Blue Springs is still the definition of summer to me. It was May, and I remember walking up the ramp to the dock with my mom and Monica, who was 15. My feet crunched on the astroturf stapled to the dock to keep you from slipping off. I was in front of them, and suddenly I heard Monica scream at my mother, "You're pregnant?" I turned, and my mother reflexively touched her stomach. I don't know if Monica guessed from my mom's tummy in the suit, but I knew from my mother's face that she was right. She was pregnant. I felt my world crumbling. Standing on that dock, I instinctively jumped, raising my hands overhead as I crashed into the water. As I sank, fear and uncertainty overwhelmed me. "Wait, my mom can't take care of us," I thought. "She can't take care of me." And as I rose back to the surface, kicking my feet, my fear hardened into anger. I was too mad to even look at her. This was going to be one more thing I couldn't talk about. My mom told Evan, and that was the end of him. His mom, a woman named Kitty, got involved and demanded my mother have an abortion. She moved Evan to Michigan or Minnesota. Either way, it was Siberia to Gainesville. Kitty worked at Joann Fabrics, where my mom bought the cloth to make crafts, clothes, and comforters. After our beautiful sister Morgana was born, we kept going to Kitty's store. Did my mom think that if Kitty saw Morgana, she would want to help? Maybe. Kitty might have hidden in the back room when we came in, because I only remember seeing her one time when my mom and I went in with Morgana. Kitty looked at us, her whole face a sneer. She turned and walked away. It was heartbreaking to see that this person wanted nothing to do with this sweet little baby, her own granddaughter. My perfect little sister Morgana, who today is one of my best friends, someone I don't even want to imagine myself not having the gift of being able to talk to. It wasn't long before we lost the apartment, too. The last night we spent there, I lay in bed, my hands clasped on my chest as I stared at the ceiling. "What is happening to us?" I said to the dark. My mom worked so hard to make the rent for the mobile home in the Arredondo Farms trailer park. Our trailer was a single wide, about 800 square feet, with three small bedrooms and a bathroom. I started my third elementary school in 3 years in Gainesville, and on that walk to school every day I stopped at the horse pasture next door. It was about 10 acres of green, with 4 or 5 horses. I had friends who could afford to bring carrots along for the walk, and we would feed the horses in the pasture. I loved them, and I made up a name for each horse. We were lucky to have the beauty of Gainesville all around us, no matter how poor we were. Gainesville is one of the most magical places on earth, with a little bit of city and so much country. I love that you can still live down a dirt road and grumble about finding snakes in your carburetor. And as kids with no money, we could spend whole days exploring. Monica, Philip, and I would go for hikes and get lost in the woods. One time in late summer, we must have walked through all of the northwest part of Gainesville. We just kept walking. It felt like we were in Narnia and we would never get home. Even when the sun started to set, I was never afraid because my big brother and sister were there. I only knew they were freaking out when we stepped into a clearing and realized we had wandered into the field of Monica's high school. "Okay," she said in obvious relief. "Okay, now I know the way." At night, we three played flashlight tag throughout the whole trailer park. When you get tagged by the light, you're it. Count to 20 or so and then go tag someone else. The secret to staying hidden is to keep moving. But I always gave myself away by laughing. Am I the only person who has to perpetually pee when playing hide and seek? We were happy. This was around the time my mom started going without food to keep us fed. Between tending to Morgana and her work schedule at the store, I think it was easy for her to hide this in the beginning. But one time we were all eating chicken and rice together, and she just sat there with water. "What about you?" I asked her. "What are you going to eat?" "Oh, I'm not hungry," she said. I didn't believe her then, and I admire her strength in doing without so much to keep the family together. The stress took a toll on her. I think having a clean, orderly house was a way to impose order on all the chaos of our lives. My mom was very meticulous about how she cleaned because it was something she could actually control. She made sure we were presentable and in clean clothes. We learned to scatter like roaches sometimes when she came home from working at the grocery store. There was a way she slammed the car door that told us that she was going to come in, guns blazing, looking for something wrong. The trailer wasn't a nice place to live, and it was important to her that we all do our part to make it look as nice as possible. If you put the dishes away incorrectly, she would pull them all out of the cupboard. "Do this over," she would yell. "Do it right this time." If she saw a bit of clothing coming out of the drawer of the dresser, all the clothes would be on the ground. "Refold everything," she would order. "Start again." When she finally left Food for Less and started working at the University of Florida in the Contracts and Grants Department, it seemed like my mom was getting on her feet. But the stress only seemed to show more. Of course, you think things like this are your fault when you're a kid. I don't remember spending a lot of time with her because she was working. And when she wasn't, I just felt like I was always in the way. Monica and Philip would babysit, but they were teenagers who didn't want to be around a kid. I felt alone. My mom had so much on her plate and didn't have the help of a partner, or really anyone. She was always cute and quick with a joke, so guys noticed. And soon after getting the job at the university, she started dating a man named Paul, who had a comb over and glasses. I didn't like him. When I was about 10, I came home from school to find he was trying to get my mom to do mushrooms. Anyone who knows my mother knows that that was not going to happen. After that, I absolutely hated him and wouldn't talk to him. Another time I came home to find them messing around, I heard the sound you don't want to hear and fled. It just made me feel weirded out. So I decided once again that I would never go straight home after school. I played outside or went to my friend's house where they had better snacks or cooler toys. Or steady electricity. I feel bad about that now. My mom was around the age I am now, and she deserved companionship. She deserved to be sexually active and have pleasure and feel fulfilled. But our family life was so erratic that small issues could be disastrous. One morning there was a huge thunderstorm. I asked my mom if she could drive me up the road to my friend Christy's house so I could get a ride to school with her and her dad. My mom had a brown Corsica hatchback. Somehow she drove through a wide puddle and the car stalled out. "Damn it, Christy," she said, hitting the wheel with her fists. "How am I getting to work?" It started up later when it dried out, but I still felt like I had made my mother's life hard. I had made a point to stop asking her for anything. And look what happened when I did. Look what was happening because I was a burden who simply existed. Everything was my fault, all of it. Monica dropped out of high school at 16 to help take care of Morgana. It felt like another bit of order and certainty falling away. And yet her sacrifice seemed practical in the moment. What else was she supposed to do? I cannot imagine the weight of the responsibility on my sister. Monica is one of the toughest people I know. A person who uses all that strength she has in the service of love and family. The second I think about what she did, I immediately start crying. So bear with me. It's tears of gratitude, but also tears for the loss of her normal childhood. I know now that when families are in crisis, kids blame themselves, and kids also take on adult burdens, which is why it's important that I say something else. Arredondo Farms is still there, and I won't say a single bad thing about it. People look down on people who grow up in trailer parks. I get it. There's a stereotype. But if you are a young person living in one now, or just a person who is made to feel that your surroundings are not good enough, remember that your soul is what matters. Your body is a vessel for your soul, and what surrounds that vessel, whether it's a mobile home or a brown Chevy Corsica hatchback that stalls out in the rain, is nowhere as important as what is inside you. 3. Too much but not enough. My mom went dancing one night with my Aunt Debbie, my father's brother's ex-wife. I suppose they had a lot in common. They went to a tiny club at the Holiday Inn, and that night, with Aunt Debbie as her wingman, my mom met Trigger. Trigger was a childhood nickname from when he had been obsessed with the Roy Rogers Show in the 1950s. Trigger was the name of Roy's horse, and he told my mom that as a kid he thought Roy was named Trigger, causing his family to tease him. The name stuck. Trigger had a good job with Coca-Cola and seemed stable, which is what my mom needed. He lived with his daughter, Rebecca, in a small, single-story, cinder-block house on a dead-end road in Gainesville. Monica was living in a tiny studio with her boyfriend by now, and Philip had moved down south to Miami because my mother simply couldn't control him. She ultimately begged for Mark's help, and for once, he came to the rescue. So, my mom, Morgana, and I moved into Trigger's house a year after my mom met him. Right in time for me to start third grade at another new school. I don't blame Rebecca if she resented us for infiltrating her house and felt like we stole her daddy away. She was Philip's age, 16, and get this, Rebecca and my brother had dated before my mom and Trigger even met. I know it's the South, but you can't make this stuff up. I was just excited to be in a real neighborhood again. I remember feeling the same way I did in that first house we moved into after the divorce. Finally, we're going to have a really cool life. Things are going to be okay. It was, but it wasn't. Trigger had a lot of rules, and one was that he had to be served dinner first. If my mom put any of our plates down before his, he would simply refuse to eat. I remember how angry he got when she made that mistake once. He threw the entire plate of food against the wall and stormed off. He also decided I was fat and lazy, so he created a chore list just for me. Wash and dry the dishes, quietly. He didn't want to be disrupted while watching TV. Sweep the driveway until there was not a leaf in sight. Clean the bathroom. Take out the trash. Anything he could think of to keep me busy. He said it was to give me a work ethic. To him, I was a problem to be solved. He would say about Mark nodding in my direction, "He's not around." He had to raise the child the other guy had abandoned. My mom married Trigger at the courthouse. None of us went. Soon my mother was pregnant again with another beautiful girl she named Abigail. Thank goodness they didn't go with the other name they were thinking of, Jubilee. Trigger loved having his two biological children in the house and was even welcoming to Morgana. Me, not so much. Trigger seemed to resent my existence. I couldn't do anything right. He worked from 4 in the morning to 3 in the afternoon, so it felt like he was in the house all the time I was there. My mother was always at work, so she didn't see how he treated me. In the living room, I would sit with my arms crossed over my body, trying to be as invisible as possible. Sitting Bull, he and Rebecca called me. I knew he hated any noise I made, but if I was quiet, he would demand, "Why are you so quiet?" If I hid in my room, I would hear, "Why are you wallowing in there?" He pronounced it wallerin', comparing me to a pig flopping in mud. "You're lazy. You ever gonna get up and do something?" It was as if he hated to have to even look at me. My body seemed to offend him, but he couldn't help but stare, especially when I was eating. Trigger and Rebecca joked about putting a lock on the refrigerator door. We had lived with a lack of food in the house for so long that when it was there, I felt like I had to eat it before it disappeared again. I discovered that food gave me a comfort like nothing since Graham's made those grilled cheese sandwiches for me. Food was something to look forward to. My only happiness. I was constantly nitpicked about anything I did. But I couldn't let Trigger ruin this for me. And so I began to hide my eating. I'd get up in the middle of the night and I'd eat. I'd sneak food from the kitchen to eat in the bathroom. I meet people who say, "Oh, I felt so bad that I ate a dozen bagels." Well, that's never been my problem, and it wasn't that I ate a lot. It was what I ate. Cookies, chips, things I could eat as fast as possible to avoid detection. Things that would give me the brief bliss of numbness and take my mind off of what was going on around me. My other secret joy was entertaining my sisters. I had a boombox and would record interviews with them like a newscaster. They were young, so their answers to my questions were hysterical. As soon as we recorded ourselves, we would immediately play the tape back and fall on the floor laughing. One time, we were all in the family room watching something when Morgana got bored. "Chrissy, do the voice," she said. Everyone looked at me, so I pretended not to know what she was talking about. I just wanted to fade into the background. "Do the voice," she said again. So I did, presenting the beginning of the evening newscast. She howled, and both Trigger and my mom smiled at me. For that moment, I actually felt good. It became a thing in the family, with them asking for the impressions I'd picked up of actors or people we knew. I loved entertaining and the feeling I had all over me when I could make them happy. I think I was trying to figure out what joy was. I don't remember why Trigger hit me the first time. I know he thought I had it coming for a while. I bet I was too loud putting away the dishes. Or I didn't put his Coca-Cola in the fridge and he wanted a cold Coke. That would usually do it. He never punched my face, just my body, the thing that offended him so much. He shoved me, slapped me, punched my arm, and yanked my wrist. He would hit me if he thought I looked at him wrong. Whether there was a warning depended on the situation, like if I didn't say, "Yes, sir." "You did the driveway?" he'd ask. "Yeah." He'd be up and towering over me in a second, slapping my arm as if he were trying to revive a dead person, and then he'd grip where he'd hit. "What's that?" he'd yell. "Yes, sir." He'd squeeze harder. "I didn't hear you." "Yes, sir." But mostly he hit me over things he imagined I did. I remember being on the kitchen floor after he knocked me over, and I was literally begging to know what it was that I did. He just shoved me hard with his foot. I convinced myself that my mom simply didn't know what was happening, or just how miserable I was. I believed that if she could see the abuse, she would stop it. Then Trigger went ballistic on Morgana over something while my mom was in the house. She stopped him, insisting, "You will not do to those girls what you do to Chrissy." So, she did know. I was heartbroken. In that moment and in the years after, I felt neglected and unimportant. Even when I heard her acknowledge what was being done to me, I told myself she just didn't know the extent. Because if she knew how much I was being abused and tormented, she would leave. It wouldn't be enough that Trigger didn't drink and he was a good provider. But I was afraid to tell her, because I was afraid that she really did know, and stayed anyway. Looking back, I can see she made a difficult choice, and I can't judge her for it. My mom had a toddler and a baby, and she knew what would happen if she was on her own. She had started over after the divorce, and then again with Trigger. She didn't think she could do it again. I wanted to tell Grams, of course, but I didn't want to worry her more. She didn't visit us anymore, and I think it was because she had an aversion to Trigger. "It'd be so nice if you could live here with me, Chrissy," she said. She was on Social Security and living in a retirement home, so that was a dream. Monica had spent a month with her, and it had been this big secret that, if revealed, would get her kicked out of the retirement home. But I would have loved to have someone happy to see me again. To get away from the physical and emotional warfare, I spent as much time as possible at friends' houses. One of my best friends in the neighborhood, Michelle, lived about a half a mile away in the subdivision. I just loved her mother, Evelyn, too. She's passed on, and I still cherish her kindness. She used to drive us to school every day in her station wagon, so we didn't have to walk. Michelle was always finding a reason to be embarrassed by her mom, like we all do with our mothers, so she would sit in the back while I sat shotgun next to Evelyn. When I went to Michelle's house after school, Evelyn would make us a tray of brownies and split it down the middle. "Okay, Chrissy, this is yours," she would say, "and Michelle, this is yours." She would give us a gallon of milk and walk away. No judgment. For the record, Michelle wasn't heavy, and no, we weren't doing something wrong by wanting to eat more than one brownie. Michelle's mom did whatever it took to make her daughter happy. It was the absolute opposite of what I saw at home. My friend Liberty lived on the next street over, and I escaped there constantly. Liberty was, and is, a goddess. She was taller than all of our friends, with long blonde hair, tan skin, and big boobs. We all wondered how it was possible for her to even have boobs in the fifth grade, much less such big ones. She was part of a hippie family, and everything they did was just cool. Liberty went to a private school that I felt was super cutting edge. Her sister had Down syndrome, but we didn't see that or care about it. Most of all, I remember that there was so much peace in their house. So much love. The kicker was their parents had divorced and found other people, but they still would all visit and hang out with each other. I would watch them be kind and loving as one big unit, and I would study them like they were some rare tribe. This is what love is? When you coexist peacefully with other people? Where you strive to be a better parent? Where you put your own pride aside? I am so blessed that other families showed me what was possible. Liberty's house had two windows and a long cement porch in front. We made menus and played restaurant.